Coming up on Tech News Weekly, Micah Sargent and I talk about how the COBOL programming language is holding up unemployment checks. We talk about how we feel about Google and Apple's contact tracing system that they announced late last week. A new low-cost iPhone SE is released, maybe at the exact right time. Minecraft's ray tracing update is finally live. How Animal Crossing has become the go-to game for the quarantine, and the changing roadmap for the PlayStation 5. All that and more coming up next on Tech News Weekly. Tech News Weekly is brought to you from LastPass Studios. Stay in control when it comes to your company's access points and authentication. LastPass makes enterprise-level security simple for your remote workforce. Check out lastpass.com/twit to learn more.
Podcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWIT.
This is Tech News Weekly, episode 129, recorded Thursday, April 16th, 2020. This episode of Tech News Weekly is brought to you by IT Pro TV. Get the most up-to-date IT training with IT Pro TV. Their video courses, virtual labs, and practice tests will give you everything you need to become a successful IT professional. Visit itpro.tv/TNW for an additional 30% off for the lifetime of your active subscription. Use code TNW30 at checkout.
Hello and welcome to Tech News Weekly, the show where every week we talk to and about the people making and breaking the tech news. I am Micah Sargent, and that guy who's sometimes in frame and sometimes very close to the camera is Jason Howell. How you doing, Jason?
I'm doing pretty good.
I don't know what's going on. I'm just playing. You know, you got to keep yourself entertained. Yeah, you got to have fun when you're in the corner of your bedroom every single day for the rest of your life, apparently.
Let me out of here.
Nobody's jaded at this point. We're only a month into this little experiment. It already feels like a year. Anywho, how are you?
You know, time is an illusion, and I've never been more convinced of that than I am now. I thought it was, you know, a week ago that I had gone on, there's a long walking trail near where I live, and I thought we had taken the dogs on that long walking trail a week ago, and it was 2 weeks ago. We go outside, but to go on that trail is really fun. And it's so sad what we find fun right now in these times, but hey, it is what it is. And today's our last opportunity to do so before we have to wear masks outside at all times.
Oh my goodness. Don't even remind me. That's true. Let's talk about something. I was going to say something that might take us away from this reality, but almost everything in this show brings us right back to it.
It has to. So I saw this story this morning from The Verge, and I had seen some tweets as I do about unemployment. And my sister, for example, she was is furloughed, unemployed? I don't know. But whatever happened to her, she worked at JCPenney as a manager. She ended up having to file for unemployment. And so she was kind of talking about the period of time that it took to get that and get it working and stuff like that. And just yesterday was whenever many of the electronic deliveries of the stimulus checks had gone out. And my partner, for example, has a local bank where he is, and he was trying to access his account to see if the money had been deposited and couldn't get through because everybody was trying to get in. And it made me think about sort of the technology behind all of this, the infrastructure essentially. And The Verge apparently was thinking about the same thing because they have this excellent article talking about how COBOL is the coding language that's being used for many of the state's unemployment systems. And that, I mean, that's across the landscape. Alaska, Connecticut, our state of California, Iowa, Kansas, Rhode Island are some of the states that have a system that's backed up by COBOL. And it turns out that many developers are not using COBOL anymore and have aged out of the workforce. So they're trying to find new systems or folks who can use the system to code COBOL and sort of keep it up and running. So it's been a struggle, obviously, and they're trying to come up with new technologies. In fact, I think there was one state that said we were in the process of switching. Oh, it was Colorado. We were in the process from switching away from COBOL. And alas, all of this stuff went down. And so now we're still stuck in it and wish that we could migrate away from it. So, yeah, I don't know. It just made me think about infrastructure and how we, you know, all of this, I think, is going to lead to so many changes. And that is, it seems to be the silver lining that we're all trying to find in this is we're learning a lot right now about what works and what doesn't. And hopefully, hopefully, can we have hope that will lead to change?
Yeah, this is kind of like the legacy Windows XP problem, which is that, hey, look, it's still doing its job. It's really hard to switch away from a system that still works. You know, but it's easy from our kind of like up-to-date technology-minded perspective to be like, yeah, but it's not the latest, it's not the greatest. And granted, here it seems to be actually slowing things down. So maybe this is the critical moment where they say, okay, maybe we do need to upgrade these systems. But who knows? I'm sure part of the reason why it still exists is because of bureaucratic, you know, red tape and why, you know, maybe it's super expensive. Well, I imagine it probably is very expensive to replace these systems and not being certain what to replace them with. But it's also probably that it's just it's done its job consistently enough over the course of 40 years that there was maybe less reason to update that when a different system or you know money earmarked for something else seemed much more of a priority. Now we're starting to see kind of the cracks in that legacy. But it just reminds me of Windows XP because this happened with XP as well. Windows, you know, Microsoft stops supporting XP. Meanwhile, all of these, you know, shops and stores and organizations are all built around XP and really don't want to move away from it because even though it's not the latest and it's not the greatest, it still totally does the trick. But now I guess we have to move on because you're not supporting it anymore. Kind of feels the same.
Yeah, I agree. It's I don't know. I mean, obviously they are trying to stop all of the leaks, plug all of the leaks and keep things going. But eventually, you know, there's only so much plugging you can do before you've completely replaced the entire brick facade with just plugs and then it comes to crumbling. Yeah.
That's right. They should really move to basic. If they just moved to basic, the whole system would be smooth.
Frankly, I think they should switch to Java, not even JavaScript, but Java.
Oh, Flash, actually. Personally,
oh my God,
I think
Flash.
They should move to Flash.
Yes. What? Why did they ever even try to stop using Flash? We'd all be fine if they just used Flash.
Totally. Alternate timeline.
Oh my God.
Other big news this week has surrounded Google and Apple's collaboration on creating a cross-platform decentralized contact tracing system to help track COVID-19 spread. Contact tracing is, of course, the process of tracking an infected individual, at least in the case of COVID-19, tracking someone who is known to be infected and kind of tracking who they've been in contact with, literally contact tracing, right? Tracing their steps to the people that they've come across so that you can notify those people, hey, by the way, this person had it. Maybe you should, you know, get a test, that sort of stuff. Well, now we're kind of venturing into the world of using technology to do this by means of a collaboration between Google and Apple. In this case, it's going to be using Bluetooth LE as the kind of technology behind this. Bluetooth LE, you know, has universal support across devices, a low battery impact. It also has a pretty short proximity, which is useful for knowing how close someone is to another. And it doesn't rely on location data. So Google and Apple are both saying, hey, this is something that we can bake into the OS so that when someone who is known to have contracted COVID is, you know, you can basically plug this into the system somehow and be like, okay, here are the points of contact with these other people who have this running on their phones. Notify them. It's opt-in. So there are a number of ways in which this is being created with security, or rather privacy, in mind. But I think security is probably an implication here as well. But still, people are a little outside of themselves on whether to trust this or not, because in moments of like great kind of chaos and everything that's happening in this world, is that the right time to implement some a system that even a few months before people might have had a big problem with from a privacy perspective? And I think everybody's just going to have a different outlook on whether they trust this system. Micah, do you trust the system as you know right now?
So it's odd. I tend to fall on the side of rose-tinted shades, happy-go-lucky sort of hopeful about all things in the world, in which case I want to trust the system, I guess is what I would say. These companies are doing what they are able to do in an effort to help with this crisis. And what they are able to do is this contact tracing system. They can't ramp up testing. That's not their purview. And so on its face, I just appreciate the efforts that are being made. But underneath it, yes, I think that I don't know if trust is the right word, because it's, to me, it's not necessarily about I don't know how to put this. So here's the thing. Apple has, and I can only speak about that company given my vast knowledge of that company versus Google. And Apple has time and time again shown its commitment to privacy, its users' privacy. They literally fought the FBI over the implications of data use and privacy. And they constantly make it a line item on everything that they do, letting you know exactly how data will be used, what will or will not be used, their differential privacy methods, all of these things that they put in place to make sure that the individual user is safe, but also they are safe in the sense that it is safe in the sense that it cannot take your data. It doesn't want the keys. Apple does not want the keys. And so in that aspect, I do put a certain bit of my trust and faith in this effort to create a system that will work. That said, we are all in the midst of this crisis, and there are we all respond differently to trauma. And one of the sort of global ways that folks respond to trauma is by looking for ways to be able to control what's going on around them and find control in their lives, because they feel like their lives are out of control because they don't have control over this crisis. And I think that giving up a certain amount of privacy, potentially, or even just the idea of having something tracking your location without understanding how the technology works, goes against that, flies in the face of gaining control of a system. And so in that sense, I think that there is a trauma response to being more skeptical about this than maybe we normally would. And I find that interesting, because usually the everyday person is not necessarily paying as much attention to this and thinking about like Facebook having their location and Instagram having the location, et cetera. So it's been interesting from the psychological standpoint, looking at how folks are being more aware and more concerned about themselves being tracked in this way.
Yeah. And I think there's a lot of misunderstanding about how this technology works, because it's super early. They're still kind of creating the plan for it. And so people in some ways could take this plan and kind of lump it together with previous brouhahas, whatever you want to, kerfuffles would be another one, around privacy, and say, oh, they are the same, when maybe they are not. Although there are a whole lot of skeptical people out there about this who feel like this is a greater plan of something much larger than beyond and extends beyond even the coronavirus. And like, okay, well, this is the foot through the door, and then you'll see what'll happen. And the heck knows at that point? Ultimately, my concern is of the now, and if this allows people to have more insight into whether they are their direct impact on their lives is affected, like they might have actually contracted the coronavirus. This is technology that could tell them, hey, go get tested. That way, you know. Then I kind of think I'm all for it. And I'm with you. I trust Apple a little more than I do Google, just from track record perspective and all the level of tracking that Google does. But them working together on a decentralized system, it's a total collaboration. I don't know. I have faith, crossing my fingers, that they're doing it the right way and that they're doing it for the right reasons. And that when this is all over, maybe it disintegrates and they're like, okay, it served its purpose.
Yeah, it was needed for this, and we're not going to use it. Yeah, outside of this, that's my hope because I think that was on Twit this past weekend. Georgia Dow was kind of talking about the concern there, and that is the concern that once you give over something, then you don't typically get it back. But we have to look at the difference between a government and these private companies, or these sure. You know, I guess publicly traded companies. But you get what I mean there.
Yep, absolutely. And, you know, it can sometimes those lines can kind of blur together as well. But yes, Micah.
Yes. Sorry.
I thought you had something.
No, that's all.
You had an "ah" there that I misread. All right. Let's take a break. You're "us" for the break. Let's take a break. And we're going to be coming up here talking with Dan Morin from Six Colors about Apple's new low-cost iPhone SE. Might be the perfect time for a low-cost iPhone right now, actually. But first, this episode of Tech News Weekly is brought to you by IT Pro TV. Now, as a busy working professional, it can be difficult to learn new skills or even make a career change. And IT Pro TV has made learning IT and finishing IT certifications possible. And right now, with everything that's going on in the world, you know, travel restrictions, social distancing, shelter in place, all those things, it has never been a better time to visit itpro.tv/TNW and sign up for the remote learning opportunities that IT Pro TV has to offer, that they excel at. Binge-worthy learning for IT professionals, fresh content, as the IT world is constantly changing. It's in their core values to have content that is current, that's relevant, and up to date. You know, like the latest exam objectives or new certifications, updated software releases, redesigned interfaces, and more, all of it included. There are over 4,000 hours of IT training that they offer, and they are the official video training partner for CompTIA and have 12 CompTIA on-demand courses, including CompTIA A+, Network Plus, and Security Plus certs. And for those organizations out there who might actually be thinking of canceling an upcoming conference, IT Pro TV can help deliver and facilitate virtual conferences. Basically the same thing, just done online. They can take a conference online with general sessions and breakout sessions with speakers live in studio or remotely. So see how IT Pro TV can make it easy for you to grow your career. Right now, go to itpro.tv/TNW and use code TNW30. You'll receive 30% off. That's itpro.tv/TNW. Use code TNW30 for an additional 30% off for the lifetime of your active subscription. IT Pro TV, build or expand your IT career and enjoy the journey. And we thank IT Pro TV for their continued support of Tech News Weekly and the Twit Network.
Awesome. Well, folks, once again, we've had a little bit of news, tech news that's taken place, some product launches in the midst of all of this. A little bit of a shock, a little bit of a surprise, and something that, you know, we had been expecting for a while. And so I thought that since Apple has announced and released the iPhone SE, the budget model iPhone, and did an early release of the keyboard, that we would have my good friend and pal and co-host of Clockwise on the show, Dan Morin from Six Colors, to talk to us. Hello, Dan.
Hi, guys. How you doing?
Doing all right. Hanging in there. Thank you for being with us today.
Always a pleasure.
All righty. So let's get into it. I'm going to start with the small thing before we move on to the big thing. And so the small thing, well, I guess it depends on who you are. It's a big thing for me, but it's a small thing in the scheme of things. And that is the keyboard, the new keyboard case that Apple has had announced for the iPad Pro. And it comes in both the 11-inch and 12.9-inch variants, and it has a cantilever design, and it sort of has the iPad floating above the keyboard with a trackpad. And this was originally supposed to launch in May. They said the keyboard would be coming in May, but Apple has revealed it sooner. Do we know anything about what happened there, why it's suddenly been released sooner, what's going on?
I don't think we have a really great idea. I think, though, that this fits in very much in the Tim Cook playbook of, you know, under promise and over deliver, which is to say, let's give you a conservative date where we definitely know, like, even if the worst case scenario happens, we'd be able to ship these things. And if we can beat that, great. I suspect that perhaps some of the recovery efforts in China where the manufacturing is done may have helped speed this along a little bit more in terms of those getting back up and running again. Perhaps some improvements in supply chains, or maybe they've just been able to figure out their logistics a little bit better. But yeah, this is a classic move. It's the same way when Apple does its financials, it always sort of used to really lowball. Now it's kind of a little more reasonable, but you know, you still give numbers confident of hitting because why not, right? Like you definitely want to be able to hit it. It's much better than the alternative where you overpromise and underdeliver.
Absolutely, yeah. Now this product kind of was revealed on Amazon sooner than it was on Apple's website, and there was some speculation based on that, some weight speculation based on that, where people were calculating, okay, how much does the keyboard itself weigh? How much does it weigh with the iPad in it? How does this all work? And then I believe it was your colleague Jason Snell who had asked Apple, so do you want to let us know what the weight of this actual product is? And they said, well, we're not going to talk about that just yet.
Right.
Do we have final judgment on how much this thing weighs? Is it a loose unit? What are we working with here?
It's a real big boy there, Micah. No, actually, we don't have a firm weight on it yet. And I think we're going to have to wait until it actually ships. Somebody gets to put it on a scale, which I'm sure everybody will be racing to do as soon as they get it. There's nothing in the tech specs about it, which, you know, but everybody's got, you know, people have done the math and they've tried to figure out essentially like, it's got to keep the iPad from falling over. Right. So it can't be very light. Right. It's got to have some weight to it.
Absolutely. Yeah. I've got my kitchen scale ready.
Ready to go.
Like we're doing wow, why can't I think of his name? Indiana Jones movement here where I'm trying to
place. He's got to have the bag of sand.
Yeah, exactly. All right. That's what I wanted to know about the keyboard with the trackpad. Let's move on to the more important thing. The iPhone SE has been announced. We'd heard about this for a while. Tell us about the big specs. I'm talking screen measurement. Is it going to be a 4-inch phone I fit in my big monster hand? Is it going to be a tiny phone? And I would like to know about that camera on the back because that was the most interesting thing to me.
Yeah, so if you've seen an iPhone in the last several years, an iPhone 6, 6S, 7, 8, the SE is going to look pretty familiar to you because it looks almost identical to those. It's got the same chassis design. It's got the same 4.7-inch screen as the iPhone 7 and 8 with that Retina HD. So it looks almost indistinguishable from the outside. The biggest difference might be just, you know, it's coming in black, white, and product red colors. So that's a little bit different than some of the previous ones, just in terms of the various model shades that were available. But other than that, you're not going to see a lot different here. It's got a physical home button with a Touch ID. It's going to weigh about the same. You know, honestly, it probably even fits cases for the iPhone 8. That's how similar it is. On the spec side, the biggest news is the A13 Bionic chip, which is the same chip that's basically in the iPhone 11 series. And that basically means this is like cutting edge, right? Like this is not, it may be a cheaper phone. It may be using an older product sort of design, but the internals are updated. And that's the most important part, because this is a phone that I think Apple expects people to buy and clearly hold on to for many years. The previous generation, the iPhone SE, was like 4 years ago. And, you know, people are just starting to like get desperate to replace those. And as for the camera, so it's a 12 megapixel camera with an 1.8 aperture. This is pretty much the same as the back, the sort of main wide camera you'll find on the back of the other iPhones. The biggest news with it is that it comes with the portrait mode and portrait lighting effects. And a lot of that is probably enabled by that A13 Bionic chip, which can do a lot of the heavy computational photography lifting. So you're not necessarily going to find something that's like a brand new element here, right? But it's something that it's getting used in a lot of Apple's other phones, which themselves have this lens in addition to other lenses. I think previously the iPhone XR, 10R, gosh, even I can't remember, had the portrait mode with the one lens. Unlike, you know, a lot of the other iPhones required multiple lenses and sort of, you know, interpolated data from both of them. But this one also does all those portrait lighting effects and has a couple of the lighting effects that were not available on the 10R. So again, looking at that A13 Bionic chip as a reason why it can do all of these extra features.
So the last SE was discontinued back in 2018. Is that right? So this is the first one in the last couple of years, let's say, the second generation SE. And what's happened since then, at least on the Google side of things, is that last year they had the Pixel 3a, which is their $400 kind of Pixel phone that came out that did really well. I mean, in Google terms anyways, Pixel phones in general aren't the most amazing sellers, definitely not compared to Apple. But for that price category, I mean, so many people, myself included, had the 3A at the top of the list for last year's best smartphones. It was just an amazing value. And one of the big reasons for that was because the camera was nearly identical to the camera system that you got on the more expensive Pixel phone. Do you think that the camera improvements that we're seeing here on the SE make it kind of a similar comparison, especially as we have the Pixel 4a coming out probably in the next month or two? Do you think these are very similar in that regard?
Yeah, I actually do. I think that makes a lot of sense. Like the camera mode, you know, there's certain things you're only going to get on the higher end camera, right? Like, so the night mode feature, I think, is mostly on the higher end. But you get optical image stabilization, you get, you know, digital zoom, you get the true tone flash, you get the portrait mode and all the different lightings. Like, you only have one lens, right? So it can't do sort of the ultra wide and other types of telephoto and things like that. But, you know, this is the lens that iPhones have had basically, right? Like when they had only one camera, this was the camera they had pretty much. So, you know, if you're upgrading from a, you know, 6 or an iPhone 7, then you're going to find a lot of improvements and you're not probably going to notice as much because you're not coming down from, say, an iPhone 11 or an 11 Pro, which has a lot more options in that. So I think you're right. The value is high because not only does it provide the camera that most people use for most things, it provides the features that they want and it provides at a great price.
Nice. Yeah, let's I know we've, you know, sort of bounced around about the price, but what are we looking at in total across the whole spectrum, you know, from 64, 128, 256? Because I think this is kind of shocking, honestly. It's a really good price.
Yeah, so it starts at 64 gig for $399, and then it's only a $50 jump to the 128, so double the storage for $50 more, which really seems like the sweet spot. If you go up another $100 to $549, you'll get a 256 gigabyte model. So it's not, you know, in the older days, especially that first generation of SE, there was often a feeling of sort of nickel and diming because it was a very low amount of storage for the introductory rate, and they really wanted to upsell you, whereas 64 gigs is a pretty reasonable capacity for a lot of people, especially those looking for the most affordable phone. And, you know, if you can afford to spend that extra $50 to double the storage, then I think you're going to be very happy with that indeed.
Nice. So three colors with this one, the product red, the white, and the black. Are these standard colors and displays that we've seen in the past? Typically the white one, I think, would have a white front, but the white one has a black front now. So do all three of them offer that black display on the front?
Yeah, I think they're all black on the front. I haven't seen them in person, but I think that's sort of the idea, and that the back has sort of that same kind of aluminum glass finish that you'll see on things like the 11 and the 11 Pro, but without the same colors. Obviously, the 11 Pro had that midnight green color, but I think the both the sort of black, it's actually a black. It's not a space gray for once, which is also a bit of a change. But you'll have that sort of like same uniform color on the back, as opposed to earlier models like the 7 and 8. I think, you know, you tended to get more of the sort of like silver color or gold metallic tones.
So ultra wideband chip is not in this, which it is in the most recent iPhone 11. Interestingly, that UWB chip is also not in the most recent iPad Pros. Anything to read there? Is this a technology that maybe is not meant to be Apple experimenting across its entire device space, are we reading too much into it in that way?
I think that's a great question. I don't know. I don't think we know at this point. The only place we've seen it deployed is in that iPhone 11 series, and Apple has been pretty close-mouthed about what they're going to use it for. They've discussed that it has sort of like this sort of presence sensing capability, and it allows for things like AirDrop features that are more like directional, essentially, than sort of how it works with just Bluetooth. There's a lot of rumor that it has to do with these AirTag tiles that Apple's working on, which lets you find objects that you attach them to, but very little has been said about it. So I don't know. I think probably, if I had to guess, that both on mainly the SE, I imagine it's a matter of keeping costs down. That's a new technology. It's one that hasn't been broadly deployed, and it's one that we don't really know a lot about the use cases for. So even though Apple might want this to be sort of a long-term phone that people buy, maybe they just felt like it wasn't there yet. On the iPad side, I don't know. Not everything that makes it to an iPhone always into an iPad either, right? Like 3D Touch never made it into an iPad. So perhaps this is a case where Apple's really envisioning a use case that involves the iPhone, a device that you're going to be, you know, carrying with you everywhere you go. So that would be my best guess, is that it has to do more with where Apple sees this technology going. And maybe it's a much more limited use case than we originally thought.
That makes sense. Excuse me, that makes sense. So this is the product for the masses, yeah? This is the every person's product, I would say. And, you know, you've got the Pro model, and then this is sort of the distinction where you've got they're not going to call it the budget model, but it kind of seems to be the budget model. Any last things we should know about the iPhone SE or the new keyboard that Apple has announced? Any other announcements in that news release, or was that kind of the scope of it?
That was the main part. I mean, a couple other minor takeaways on the SE side that I noted, which were: one, it has the dual SIM support that rolled out with sort of the more high-end iPhones, which means you can have an eSIM in addition to a nano SIM. And it's also got that haptic feedback that sort of replaces the 3D touch feature that we saw in earlier iPhones. I think that pretty much signs the death warrant for 3D touch in terms of a technology that Apple's going to use. It was always kind of expensive and really hard to deploy in like larger and larger screens. So yeah, I think that sort of like crystallizes a bit where the line is going and what features are going to be standard.
Gotcha. Well, Dan Morin of Six Colors, thank you so much for joining us today on Tech News Weekly. We do appreciate your insight.
Thanks, guys. Always a pleasure.
Thanks. And quickly, I forgot to say this. If folks would like to follow you online, check out the work that you do, where could they do so?
You can, of course, find me at Six Colors. I also write a weekly column at Macworld. I host the Rebound, a tech podcast. And I host Clockwise with Micah there. And I'm also an author. And I guess what? I've got a copy of my new book here. I'm going to hold it up.
OMG.
It's got a really great color.
That is an excellent cover. Wow.
Yes, the Aleph Extraction comes out on May 12th. Pre-order is up now for ebook, paper, all that good stuff. You can check out my website at dmorin.com for more on that.
Awesome. Thank you very much.
Thanks, guys.
Thank you, Dan. We'll talk to you soon. Best of luck with the book. That's amazing. I have so much respect for anyone who can write a book.
Like, I agree.
I could never do that. Like, I just don't understand.
All right. Minecraft's eagerly anticipated ray tracing facelift. Maybe you've heard of this coming down the line. Well, it's finally live. Right now might be the perfect time for its release. And joining us to talk about this and a few other gaming topics is the return, hopefully triumphant, of Sam Moskovich from Ars Technica. How's it going, Sam?
Hold on. I'm doing one of these gestures for the video viewers as you were saying all those nice things.
Yes.
Hello, it's going quite well. It's so nice to see the entire rest of the world come in line with my own recording from home life. I've had all this stuff kicking for years. It's time for everybody to come over and play board games virtually at this point. But yes, Minecraft's ray tracing facelift has been teased, talked about, hinted at for a couple of years. It was once called the super duper graphics update because Minecraft can't do anything without sounding silly. And then this ray tracing thing was announced, and part of it said RTX, and part of it said new Xbox. But now, today, if you can get through Microsoft and Mojang's hammered servers, you can download this on Windows 10. It is called the Minecraft RTX Beta, RTX being a specific NVIDIA product line. And what it does is it brings what's known as ray tracing, in this case specifically path tracing, to the Minecraft experience. The idea being, most video games, when they have anything that resembles lights or shadows, do what's known as rasterization in order to render those. So that could be sort of a trick. It could be kind of like a mirror image for a what looks like a reflection. It could be a pre-baked bit of lighting. It could be sort of a faked thing called ambient occlusion, where they fake the little bit of darkness that appears in the corner of a given scene. But when you model every single ray of light, it all looks more realistic. It also costs a ton computationally. But NVIDIA has been crowing about ray tracing for almost 3 years now, with products being in the wild for about a year and a half, 2 years. And Minecraft and RTX are quite a fusion. If you're watching the video version of this, you will be seeing some screenshots. They're at the very bottom of the article for the producer that show the before and after of what happens. Keep scrolling, producer, all the way to the bottom. For the before and after of what happens when you turn the effects on and off. It's this incredible light bounce. Keep going, producer. You are not there yet.
Many carousels to your article.
Yeah, well, the thing
it's right there.
The images of it are crucial because you get these incredible light bounce effects with or without this turned off. And Minecraft is one of these things that looks janky, old, 8-bit. It's all really blocky. And you might say to yourself, how high-tech can it look? Well, I've been testing it for about 5 days, and I've never seen anything like it.
That is really cool. So, all right. So, obviously, this is Windows 10 right now. You mentioned something about it coming to, you know, the Xbox at some point. Like, what kind of hardware is required to get this up and running? This isn't something that just anyone with a Windows 10 machine can get this going. You need specific hardware in your system, right?
That is correct. One of my warnings I had in the article is, if you've got kids browsing the internet, put this article on your block list for any of your children on their net nanny, because it is expensive. You need what's known as an RTX graphics card. Technically, you need just anything that supports ray tracing, but only NVIDIA's RTX graphics cards, which start at $350 and go all the way up to the consumer price, scare quotes, of $1,200, support this. But you also need a decent processor and so on. You basically need a gaming PC, and a gaming PC with an NVIDIA RTX card. AMD does not yet have a ray tracing equivalent. But from there, if you own Minecraft, you don't have to buy another version of Minecraft. You go in to the Windows Xbox Insider Hub on Windows 10, which is currently being slammed. Its servers are crashing. And then just claim it as a beta. And what this beta does is it puts you in a sandbox, so you can't share your worlds that currently exist with your friends like in an easy one-click way. You have to import them, or you have to use other pre-made things. And NVIDIA's posted a bunch of guides. But because it's a closed beta, or not a closed beta, but as an open beta, there are some hoops to jump through. But once you have all that pipeline together, then yes, you can jump in. And there's no console version yet. There's no phone version yet, because this is so beefy, because it requires such incredible hardware.
Cool. Well, and it's the perfect time right now, because everybody is trying to fill their time with, particularly games. If I trust what I see on Twitter right now, everybody's talking about games.
In particular, I see a lot of chatter about Animal Crossing New Horizons that came out, I think, about a month ago. You actually did a review of this game a month ago. It's on the Nintendo Switch. Bringing it up now just because it seems like it's an escape for a lot of players right now. Why is there so much love for this game? I don't have the console, so I can't play it, and I kind of want it. I want to be in on this, but what's all the rage about?
Well, Animal Crossing has been around for a long time. Came out on the N64 in Japan. Mm-hmm. If you want to go back that year 2000, 2001, right around there, and it's subsequently come out mostly on portable systems. Or there's a really crappy smartphone version that came out in 2017, which I do not recommend because it's got a bunch of microtransactions and garbage. But this idea that Nintendo finally has a really popular platform that plays nicely in portable mode, that plays nicely on your TV, and that Animal Crossing can slip into, it just seems like a game that people have had an affection for a long time has finally arrived in a way that a lot more people can get into. But there's also the Twitter effect, the social media effect. Let's be honest, the Nintendo Switch makes it super easy to tap one button and take any cute little moment in Animal Crossing and dump it onto whatever social media platform you love. And the FOMO that you can kind of produce with this is incredible. And that's what I predicted, because I wrote the review before the game came out. I said, this is going to be every single place you look digitally. You will see people sputtering around, catching fish, doing little chores, little errands, and kind of recreating their physical lives. Because Animal Crossing New Horizons, like all the others, is about the minutiae of living in a busy town with a whole bunch of virtual critters that, you know, talk and that ask you for your favors, that you can do all kinds of physical everyday labors. And that I kind of predicted, because I got my copy at the very end of February, and I'm in Seattle, which kind of got hit earlier than other major American cities in terms of citizens being told maybe you should stay home. So I hid starting February 28th with my copy of Animal Crossing and found that it fit very neatly into my quarantined life. So the ability to do these sort of real life things, to comment on what it is we miss from this sort of physical life that we all used to just take for granted, and to do so with cute little critters like Tom Nook, it all adds up to a pretty obvious formula of FOMO, of, oh, that's cute, oh, I can share this, I can relate to it, and then other people say, I want it. Oh, and then the Switch is sold out everywhere. So then you add that extra little bit of exoticness.
Yeah, we all want what we can't have, especially right now. It seems like we can't have a lot. Now, this game has seen 3 million in domestic sales, not including digital sales so far since launch. Do you think that it would have had such a strong performance if it came out at a different time? I know it was delayed, but I mean, it really does seem like the time was kind of ripe for a game like this.
I mean, honestly, even without everyone in pandemic quarantine, I do believe it would have done pretty much as well, if anything, with greater store sales, because the Switch's release schedule hasn't had a hit for a minute. It hasn't had a bona fide, oh, we love this series and everybody talks about it and we're going to get it. Luigi's Mansion 3 was the last one, and I think I got 1,000 eye rolls in chat just now because Luigi's just not Mario. He's not a star in the way that Animal Crossing has built up a reputation for years. So I think it would have done well. It just, the serendipity of it being this very good, oh, I need ways to have it gives you a routine. It's like a digital bonsai tree is how I describe the game, that you're always going in and snipping a little bit and then coming back because everything is time gated. It checks the clock on your system, and you're logging in on the internet to share stuff with friends, so you can't do the fake the clock trick if you want to play it socially. So that adds up to a game that you really do have to create sort of a schedule for, a routine for. And I don't know about you, but sometimes I forget what day it is, but Animal Crossing reminds me because there's a stock market whose prices go up and down based on what day and what time of day. So that absolutely adds to the appeal.
Now I want to play it even more. Not that I could like totally find time for it in my life, because even though I'm just in this house, I find that I'm like busier now than I have been in a really long time.
I can't believe you're not going to try and share it with your family, because it is a shareable game. You create one island, and then however many people use that same Switch, share it, which actually has caused people to go crazy in relationships because they find that they share their island very differently. There's a whole other branch I could go down if we're going to talk about relationships in quarantine.
That is awesome. All right. Well, maybe I'll have to, you know, be in the throngs of people looking for a Switch. I'll think about that. Finally, Bloomberg reported yesterday that the upcoming PlayStation 5 might actually be limited when it's launched this holiday season. What exactly is the news there?
Yeah, we got Bloomberg citing some apparently sources close to the matter saying that they're not going to make as many PlayStation 5s in the launch window. And it's conjecture from there as to exactly why. The sources aren't saying exactly what Sony's doing. And so from there, it's sort of us guessing that Sony's saying, well, we are producing a decent number of these things, but we're also going to mark the price up to somewhere near $500 or $550 US, which is considered pretty high for a console launch. We haven't seen that exact figure, anything of $500 or above, in a few console generations. And previous console generations that launched that high did not do well. So it's a question of, well, is it because the parts cost so much that they are pricing it that high? Are they pricing it that high because they figure people are just going to buy it and resell it on eBay anyway? There's question marks there. But the point is, whatever limited supply there was already going to be, because consoles always launch in pretty limited fashion, it's going to be even more severe. And that's happening in a crazy economic time.
Yeah, no kidding. Now, on the top of that article, we saw a little shot of the DualSense controller, which you actually wrote about this last week. We kind of got our first glimpse of the controller for the PlayStation 5. What do you think? Are there things that this controller can do that the DualShock cannot do, or is it just a pretty panda-looking device?
Well, it's funny. Just now I was talking about the limited info we have on the price. We also have limited info on the controller, and Sony's doing a whole lot of drip feed. I don't think they wanted this today's news about price necessarily being the good news drip feed, but the controller is called DualSense, and we thought that that might have to do with some patents that were uncovered about biometric sensors that might be in a controller, but Sony hasn't said anything about that. Instead, this thing rumbles a lot. It's got essentially, if you've played with a Nintendo Switch controller, you may have noticed something called HD Rumble, and there's only a very small number of games that support this in a really interesting way. But the idea is that there's a frequency level vibration tweak, meaning you can get it to rumble as much or as little in any place in the controller as you want, which for some Switch things makes it feel like there's a little tiny ball rolling around inside of it. It's a trippy thing that few games use, and Sony seems to be interested in having that spread out across a giant full controller as opposed to a tiny Nintendo Joy-Con, and to have it supported in many more games and even add the touch sense to those triggers. So imagine playing a game with a bow and arrow. This is what one thing they suggest. And you press down on the trigger and it adds an extra bit of resistance based on what it is you're doing in the game. Same thing could go for a car in terms of whether you're pulling the clutch or slamming on the brakes. Same thing could go with all kinds of other software. So that's what they've hinted at. And that is the most interesting thing that they've publicized. Now, the question is, how much is this thing going to cost? Are all these extra sensors and rumbly bits going to jack up the price? And also, how is virtual reality going to work? Because the controller has one little thing. If you look at it, they didn't talk about this. The light bar has moved. There used to be a giant glowing light on the back of the PS4 controller. That's not there on the PS5 controller. They've moved it to be more of a cute, tiny accent. It looks more aesthetic than useful. So does that mean it won't be used in VR? Does that mean the VR system will have a totally different tracking system? They've hinted to PlayStation 5 getting virtual reality at some point. We don't even know exactly if or when that's going to happen. So there's a little bit of faith there. So again, Sony's giving us just that little bit of drip feed, a little bit of interesting info, and a controller that ultimately looks more like an Xbox controller, which kind of cracks me up. If you actually take that image, that white, black, and blue robot-looking thing, and just paint it entirely black, it's got Xbox-like dimensions, which is a really interesting way for them to admit that maybe Microsoft beat them.
Yeah. Interesting stuff. I'm looking forward to finding out more about the PlayStation 5 and all this stuff. And I love getting you on right now, especially. Well, I always enjoy having you on the show, Sam, but especially right now, because I don't know, games are kind of a glimmer of happiness for a lot of people right now. And so it's good to keep talking about them so that we can see what kind of games we need to find for our library and take our minds off of things a little bit.
Sure, Sam Skovich. We at Ars Technica, we're covering all that stuff, and you can head to arstechnica.com for more on lots of games you can play with people you love while you're all at home. And you can find me at Sam Red on the Twitter. I think Jason was about to set me up for that, so I just beating you to the punch.
I'd rather hear you say it.
And we'll do game stuff soon.
Right on, Sam. Take care of yourself. Enjoy your games. We'll talk to you soon. All right. And that, as they say, or as we say at the end of our show, is that mm-hmm. Tech News Weekly publishes every Thursday at twit.tv/TNW. That's where you can go to subscribe. Make sure you subscribe. That way you get your episode automatically downloaded to your device so that you can listen to it when you're just hanging out, washing dishes, or maybe you're going for a walk. Make sure and wear your mask. Whatever you're doing, I mean, you can find a half an hour, 45 minutes to an hour of time to throw those earbuds in and listen to it. And if you subscribe, you don't have to think about the extra step, which is going to find the episode. It's just there for you. It's like magic.
Like magic. You, of course, can, like magic, be a part of the show by emailing us at tnw@twit.tv. And, of course, follow us on social media. Jason Howell is absolutely killing it with some great social media vids as of late. But no pressure. You know, you do what you can. And that's all you need to do. But I know I've been getting a chuckle out of them. They've been great. So you can check those out, of course, by following him, but also by following Twit on Twitter. That's at Twit on Twitter, at twit.tv on Instagram. I think we're still posting to TikTok. That's at twittalk on TikTok. If you want to tweet at me or follow me, I'm at Micah Sargent on pretty much all of the social media platforms. And of course, you can check out Hands on iOS. The next episode publishes later today. And today we're talking about Do Not Disturb. There's so much to learn about Do Not Disturb, and I'm so excited to have a video out about that soon. What about you, Jason?
Oh, I love Do Not Disturb. It's one of my favorite features, at least on Android anyways. Yeah, good stuff. I'm at Jason Howell on Twitter. That's where you can find me there. And then twit.tv/HOA for Hands on Android. Today's episode went up just, I think, an hour ago. And it's on taking, if you have a spare Android tablet just hanging around and you want to be more productive now that you're working at home, maybe you had a dual screen setup at work and now at home you have a single screen setup, just your laptop. Take that tablet, turn it into a second display, and boom, you're in business. And I show you how to do that on Hands on Android, twit.tv/HOA. Thanks to everyone at the studio for helping out. Of course, John is pushing the buttons. I know Burke's there as well as the engineer. They are keeping safe social distance and they are wearing masks, so they're taking care of themselves. I'm happy to know that. And thanks to you. I hope you're taking care of yourself too. We'll see you next week on Tech News Weekly. Bye, everybody.